Goeiemôre en baie welkom by Gesondheid op RSG. Ek gesels vandag verder met professor Wolfgang Preiser en ons gesels oor die COVID-virus variante en die entstowwe. Professor Preiser is hoof van virologie by die Universiteit van Stellenbosch en ook die Tygerberg Hospitaal. Ek gee net 'n baie kortlikse opsomming van die hooftrekke van die gesprek van verlede week. In die eerste plek is neem kennis daar is verskillende variante van die COVID-virus en ons neem hoofsaaklik kennis van die variante wat meer aansteeklik is of wat ernstiger siekte veroorsaak. Daar's baie ander variante en daar's lyste daarvan wat ons nie eens bespreek nie omdat dit nie die mens so siek maak soos die oorspronklike virus nie. Neem ook kennis dat die entstowwe is wel effektief genoeg teen Suid-Afrikaanse en ander variante. Dis nie perfek nie, maar doeltreffend genoeg. Variante kan nie geïdentifiseer word as die oorspronklike virus nie geïsoleer en geïdentifiseer is nie. Moenie die fopnuus glo dat die virus nie geïsoleer en geïdentifiseer is of dat dit nie 'n virus is nie. Nuwe variante is beslis meer aansteeklik en kan selfs die immuunstelsel omsuil en daarom versprei dit vinniger in gemeenskappe. Dit is noodsaaklik dat soveel mense as moontlik gevaksineer moet word, want hoe meer mense gevaksineer is, des te minder gasheere is daar vir die virus beskikbaar. Die groot uitbreking in Indië is moontlik nie net te wyte aan die Indiese variant nie, maar ook grotendeels omdat groot byeenkomste in Indië nie verbied is nie. Dan is dit noodsaaklik om kennis te neem dat in Israel, waar 'n groot persentasie van die bevolking nou reeds ingeënt is, dat die voorkoms van COVID baie dramaties afgeneem het. Ek sit dan nou my gesprek voort met professor Wolfgang Preiser en die vraag wat ek aan hom gestel het is oor die vinnige ontwikkeling van die COVID-vaksin. Want baie mense is juist bekommerd oor die vaksin omdat dit so vinnig ontwikkel is.
I have to say I was very pleasantly surprised to see so many of these vaccines working so well and being developed in such a short time. And of course we are now really struggling to get enough doses and there is some rare side effects that are being observed. You know, all of this was to be expected. Ultimately it's an enormous feat of human ingenuity. And I must say that deep inside I harbor the hope that when this is all over in 2 or 3 years and COVID is a mere episode and we've all sort of moved on, that we will have learned how to make vaccines against diseases, not only new ones, there are some long-standing infections against which we don't have good diseases, that we will also benefit in other ways. And I mean, there are bad diseases, very common and severe diseases like tuberculosis around, where vaccination efforts are really not very good. So I hope that this now provides a boost for the development also of other vaccines that will make our lives safer and healthier in future. My profession brings with it insights that make me have a very clear take on this. I think it is nothing short of a miracle that so many vaccines have been developed. Yes, there is a lot of confusion at the moment. What vaccine may cause what side effects and how good is the immunity against this or that or other variant and whatever. Nothing is perfect, of course. Nothing gives 100% guarantee that you will just sail through the vaccination and you'll be immune ever after. It doesn't happen like that. But on the whole, it's an absolute achievement. And I think that's one of the achievements that I hope will last and have a lasting influence on our lives.
Is die neuweffekte wat mens kry na die vaksinering, nadat jy die entstof gekry het, is dit as gevolg van die liggaam se immuunrespons op die vaksin of het dit iets te doen direk met die vaksin se inhoud?
The vaccines do not contain the virus itself. You are not experiencing an infection with this virus that would cause illness. There are some vaccines, smallpox, which is no longer used, luckily, but also measles, mumps, rubella, oral polio vaccine that contain live attenuated viruses. So these are live viruses that cause sort of very mild, clinically mild infection of the same sort that the true the proper virus that causes the disease would cause. The COVID vaccines are not like that. So it cannot be a direct effect of that. It's really the reaction of the body to the vaccination. It may be something like an allergic reaction. And of course, a vaccine contains all sorts of components. And there are people who may have an allergy against one or other. And this has been described. And in very rare cases, it may be very severe and people need to be treated for that urgently. And that is something that the vaccination sites are prepared for. It happens very rarely, but of course it may happen like with any injection. And that can happen to you when you have a tooth extracted and you get the pain injection or anything else. I mean, allergies are a fact of life. Then there are the local side effects where you get vaccinated, so the arm is sore and you may have some generalized side effects like I had them after mine, fever, headache, feeling very tired for a day. That is the body reacting to the antigens in the vaccine. So that is my body now seeing, oops, there is something foreign. Something has been injected here, which shouldn't be there. And now I must really throw my immune system at it to fight it and also to learn to recognize it and fight it in future. And that is really what the vaccine does. It's a training for the immune system. And like if one trains for the Cape Argus and you cycle 30 kilometers, you know, you will have pain in your legs and other parts of the body until you get used to it. And it's a similar thing to that, which is not severe. It's just unpleasant. I must say for me, it's a question of sort of being psychologically prepared. I mean, knowing that it happens not infrequently, quite a few of our staff here also experienced that. And if you know it's going to happen, you know, with a certain probability, then you can have your paracetamol ready or your ibuprofen. And you know that you shouldn't plan anything major for the next day, maybe even take the day off work if it's really severe. And otherwise, rest assured in the knowledge that this is a natural reaction of your body now forming immunity and being trained. And then finally, there are these rare, fortunately very rare, but sometimes very severe, even life-threatening complications, like we've now heard about the clotting complications. These are also linked to an immune reaction of the body against components of the vaccine. Its details are still being worked out, but most people I have heard talk about it who are knowledgeable about these clotting issues think it is likely linked to these vaccines. And what they say is that it's so rare that, in their opinion, it is something we just have to accept. You know, we have to accept that 1 in 100,000 will experience this, and there are sort of early warning signs. So the vaccinee needs to be informed about it so that they can seek help as early as possible if they notice something unusual, and then it can be treated, which will sort of reduce the risk of this getting really severe or even life-threatening. But there will still remain a very tiny residual risk. And I think that is just something one has to take into account. And that goes for most things in life. I heard a colleague talk about Gauteng, where one has a 1.5 million risk of being hit by lightning. Now here in Cape Town, we have far less of that, but we have traffic, which is a major killer. I think we talk about a 1 in 200,000 or 1 in 500,000 or 1 in 1 million risk of dying from a COVID vaccination. That would be after I survived the drive to the vaccination site and back. I'm not trying to belittle it in any way. I think this is, like all serious illness, is of course very bad, but it's a very tiny risk. And of course, it's very slight compared to the risk of getting the severe infectious disease due to COVID. And COVID, one of the elements of severe COVID is unfortunately also clotting issues. So it's commonly seen in patients who have severe COVID and are in intensive care. And it's in many cases also what will ultimately cause their death. Given the risk of getting COVID and then the risk of developing a severe form of the disease, the risk from the vaccine is very tiny.
Professor, dan het van die bloeddienste wat die bloedmonsters getoets het, van mense wat eintlik inkom om weer bloed te skenk of om gevaksineer te word, het hulle gesien dat 'n eintlik 'n redelike groot persentasie het reeds teenliggame teen COVID. En dat in sommige gemeenskappe self 70% van die gemeenskap reeds teenliggame het. Is dit 'n goeie ding?
It may well be. The first reason why these studies, and I'm also involved in similar studies now in different groups, not with the Blood Transfusion Service, is to see just how many cases occurred in a community that were never diagnosed. And firstly, cases may be very mild or may just be inapparent clinically, but then also during the peaks of our two epidemic waves, we were unable to cope with the number of patients. So people who were not part of a risk group, so young and healthy otherwise, who developed symptoms suggestive of COVID were just told to isolate at home and not come for testing and so on. So there is a large group, presumably, who we didn't have a chance to diagnose. And these antibody tests are meant to fill in on that, so allow us to see, okay, so what is the proportion? What's the relative frequency of infection and how many of those were severe and were tested? Some people, of course, and sadly, had severe COVID even and still didn't get to medical care. So that would also be captured if they survive by the antibody testing. But one can speculate that the majority of people who've had it will be immune at least for a while. So I think at this stage, most people would assume that for about 6 months after having recovered from COVID, you would be relatively immune against becoming infected again. And thereafter, this immunity will fade, it will go away slowly over time, and then the risk of being reinfected again, if there is a renewed surge and one is exposed again, that would increase. So in a way, it is probably not bad news. I mean, seeing that the people who were tested obviously survived the infection, and it may give us a bit of a shelter against the third wave. So some colleagues think they have done modeling and they think that because of that, the third wave will not be as devastating as the second wave. That said, I really have to also, unfortunately, add the negative aspects. We thought the same of Manaus, which is the big city in the jungle of Amazonia, on the Amazonas River, where halfway through 2020, they had a very bad first wave, and then many people were immune. And the figures were similar to what was found here. 60-70% of people had antibodies as evidence of infection. And then people basically said, well, we already have herd immunity. But then look what happened earlier this year when the second wave hit them. So firstly, a new variant of the virus may simply overcome the immunity. The immunity may not be long lasting in any case. It may not be very reliable. So it's not a reason to rest and sort of reduce any precautions. It is encouraging that so many people would have some degree of immunity possibly, but it doesn't mean that neither those nor anyone else should now sort of let down their guard and think they are safe. We are not. There are also some voices saying that what happened in India is that getting off relatively lightly last year with a very early lockdown, but then also seeing many milder infections, there was also some assumption of probable herd immunity. And now we are getting these terrible reports and pictures from India about what's happening there. And there's no evidence of herd immunity. I mean, the situation is totally out of control. And that is bad. That is exactly what luckily didn't happen in South Africa, at least not on a large scale, that the medical system was totally overwhelmed by cases and people would die for lack of oxygen and clinical care, which is an absolute tragedy and one of the reasons why it is important to control the numbers and control the outbreaks, keep the numbers as low as possible.
Professor, het gesien as ek na die wêreldkaart kyk, dat in die Asiëse lande was die tweede golf baie minder erg as in Europa en in die westerse wêreld, Suid-Amerika, Engeland en in Europa. Is dit moontlik omdat hulle dalk oor 'n langer tydperk aan miskien ander koronavirusse blootgestel was en gee dit dalk of vir ons moed dat dit in die toekoms dalk ook so kan wees meer in die westerse lande ook, dat daar 'n laer insidensie kan wees soos wat nou in Asië gesien word?
There have been lots of discussions and considerations as to whether previous exposure to other coronaviruses and you know, there are four coronaviruses that we've known about for many, many years and that have been around probably for decades, if not centuries, and that are quite common and usually causing just a common cold. So a mild, the typical flu-like illness, but not very severe. There is a little bit of evidence, but it's not very reliable. And it obviously doesn't hold true in that we are seeing in all population groups, those living in very good circumstances and those living in rather poorer circumstances, in crowded and not so good accommodation and not being very well nourished, that SARS-CoV-2 can cause severe disease. I think what distinguishes some Asian countries, Singapore, Taiwan, South Korea, Japan to some degree, even though that it may seems to be changing now. And of course, Australia and New Zealand is that they early on set it in their minds that we want to suppress this totally. So they went full out. I don't think there were many considerations about confidentiality and these things. From the reports that I hear, your cell phone basically gives you away and there are cameras and the picture emerges very quickly. And then they trace everybody that's been in contact with the case and tell them now you need to quarantine and you need to stay at home for the next 2 weeks. So it was an absolute effort. And it seems to have paid off in terms of economic development because now these countries largely behave as if nothing had happened. Their economies are taking much less of a knock than the economies of the countries. And that's so typical of the Western democracies that try to find a middle way between locking down and allowing certain activities still. So it's a constant change and up and down, which also leaves people very unhappy. I think one will have to look at it with a bit of hindsight in a few years from now and really try and analyze the differences. I don't think what was observed is biological. I don't think it's to do with some populations being less susceptible. I don't think it's to do with some populations having been exposed to related viruses that gave them some degree of immunity. I think it's a lot to do with behavior and the way in which the response in the country was organized. So one fact that is often mentioned is that in parts of East Asia, because of the air pollution and also because they're very high population density, using, for example, public transport or just walking, you're very close to many other people. People have been using masks, face masks, cloth masks for a long time already. So it is almost second nature. And I'm sure that this would give another few percentage points of protection against COVID outbreaks. So it probably rather factors like that. But most of all, probably a resolve, a political direction that said, well, we need to totally control this. We need to get rid of this thing here. Very strict controls for arriving people. You know that in Australia, you have to go into quarantine in a special hotel. Everybody gets tested very regularly because they want to keep it out. And the idea is that if we do that, then the rest of life can go on as normal. I don't think this is realistic for poorer countries and not for countries that have a lot of cross-border traffic and rely on that, of course, also like South Africa. The same doesn't fit everybody. South Korea or in Taiwan, I don't think there's a question that everybody has a cell phone or a smartphone or probably a few and all sorts of fancy devices. You wouldn't be able to do that now in Khayelitsha where, you know, many people will not have that and will not even have airtime. So it's not necessarily a model, but I'm sure there are certain things that one can learn from that. Basically looking at what worked, what didn't work, what caused more harm, what caused less harm. I mean, in terms of unwanted effects on the economy, for example, one will hopefully learn lessons from that for future pandemics.
Professor Pryser, ek kan nie die gesprek afsluit sonder om vir jou te vra, is daar 'n plek vir ivermectin?
Wow, I'm probably not the specialist to answer that. I have amongst my acquaintances and friends also different groupings. Some swear by it, others do not. May I just add that as a virologist who's been in medical virology for the past 25 years, when I started, we had very few antiviral drugs. There was just a handful. It was really acyclovir against herpes infections. It was AZT or cytarabine against HIV and not much else. In the meantime, we have 30 or 40 plus drugs against HIV, which can be controlled very well in an infected individual, several drugs against different types of herpes virus infections for different types of cases. We have drugs, which was unheard of at the time, against chronic hepatitis virus infections that are a total lifesaver that really can cure it and, you know, prevent all the negative long-term effects like liver cancer. So there's been amazing progress. Now, it came after many years of very hard basic research. So basically there was millions and millions of dollars and euros put into basic research, some of which then gave leads, which was then taken up by the pharmaceutical industry that of course saw business in there, that then went and developed these drugs. And for each drug that makes it to the market because it's found effective and safe and so on, for each drug there are like dozens that fall by the wayside that look promising at first, are then tested and turn out to have unacceptable side effects, too often, too frequent and too severe, or are simply not effective enough. So to expect any drug, and it started with chloroquine more than a year ago, ivermectin and several others, to expect a drug that's been sitting in our shelves for many years, I mean, in this case, many decades, to by pure chance have a major effect on that virus, it doesn't seem plausible. From the start, I would be skeptical because I know how clever these little viruses, and of course they're not clever, they are just biochemical molecules, but how they have evolved to hijack cells and use a lot of what the cell does for their own purposes. So in order to harm the virus, but not kill the cell and ultimately the whole body that carries the cell, I mean the patient, it's really a very difficult thing to do. So never say never, of course, and I would not rule out that certain drugs that are known already would help in some respect, but it could also be indirect, less than sort of dealing with the virus itself, maybe it dampens an immune response, which is too strong and does damage in its own right. So there are many effects that a drug could have that could be beneficial. For ivermectin, there are some studies that show some effect, other studies that do not. Looking back at over the first year of such efforts, it is actually sad, and I'm not the first one to say that so many small studies and trials have been done. But unfortunately, with very few exceptions, none of them was designed well enough and also big enough to really give a conclusive answer. So what one would really want to do is to test almost identical groups of patients that are very well comparable. One gets the drug, the other one does not, and then see what is the difference in outcome. There are very few of these studies of the necessary quality. So a lot is sort of, yes, I have a small series, I've tried this in patients, they did well, but we don't know, they might have done well anyway. So, you know, it's a difficult thing. And if you give something to somebody who's already on a ventilator and is in a very bad state, yeah, of course, maybe the drug needs to be given earlier to make a difference. So I personally have never thought of trying to get hold of ivermectin through whatever channel in order to treat myself or my family. I must say I'm too much based in medicine to accept this as something worth trying. I would really want to see evidence that it is effective and that it is safe. And then that is something that I would consider. Ultimately, I think, you know, one needs to do a proper study. And I'm also aware of cases, and that was here in our faculty, where trials of different drugs were happening. And then it was in between the first and the second wave. Of course, nobody knew the second wave was on its way. And then the funders withdrew funding because they said, well, you're taking too long to recruit enough patients to participate in the trial, so you're not getting there. And then the funding was withdrawn. Very disappointing, of course, for everybody that's put on a lot of effort into this trial. And then a few weeks later, the second wave hit. And within a few weeks, within 2 or 3 weeks, we would have recruited all the numbers of patients needed, and we would have had very good results. I mean, we could have really told, okay, it works or it doesn't work. So these are all missed opportunities. I think there's a lot we can learn to improve for future health emergencies, that studies are started early but are designed in a way to really give a very good answer, you know, whether positive or, no, or not, but, you know, you want the evidence. And for that, you need to do good studies. I think the vaccine studies were generally better done than most of the medicine studies, the drug studies. I never considered that for myself because I don't see the evidence to be sufficient for ivermectin or any of the other drugs. And in fact, one disappointment is that, of course, with the exception of the corticosteroids that are given in a more advanced, more severe cases and that do save lives, that has been shown, and that is, of course, now standard treatment, that many of the other drugs, that some of which were developed specifically against viruses, don't seem to make a major difference. So it's not a very good state of affairs. It's a bit disappointing and sad, but it just shows that viruses are a difficult thing to treat. And to come up with a good drug that kills the virus, that combats the viral replication, but doesn't harm the host, is still a very difficult thing to do.
As jy in een sin 'n finale boodskap moet gee vir die luisteraars, wat sal daai kernboodskap wees?
It's a very brief one, and it's really more from human to human than from a medical professional or scientist to the public. We are all fed up with this. We've had a very rough year, most of us, and had to make many sacrifices. And many of us have seen and lived through a lot of suffering and loss. I think we need to stick in there for a few more months. If you look and read reports and watch reports from the countries that have gone ahead with vaccinations and how they are reopening and how it is becoming safer for them. Yes, we are behind. Yes, we have that variant, but we will be getting there. It'll take a bit longer. And until then, please do keep your mask on. Do keep the distancing. Do try and meet outdoors. Do all those things that we've learned and that nobody likes particularly much, but that do help. And do go and get your vaccine shot when you're eligible and invited to do so. So please, let's get the end game ready. It's not a short game. It's going to be many, many months, maybe another year or so. But in the end, we will have a population that is largely protected directly or protecting one another. And until then, please, let's keep those measures up. Try and live life as much as we can, but with certain precautions and not let down now. Let India be a warning. And I must say, this is absolutely dreadful of a country that thought they were safe and reopened and started living life as before and now getting the most horrific of consequences. It may still happen to us, so I don't think we can feel safe from that. So please stick to these things for many more months. And do get the vaccination when you're offered. And let's get through this.
Baie, baie dankie. My gas vandag was professor Wolfgang Preisser. Hy is hoof van virologie by die Universiteit van Stellenbosch en die Tygerberg Hospitaal. En soos hy gesê het, asseblief, gaan vir jou enstof wanneer jy die kans kry. Wees versigtig, hou maar die sosiale afstand en moenie laat ons met ons broek op ons knieë gevang word, soos Indië nie. Tot volgende week dan, wanneer ek weer oor gesondheidsake gesels, groete van my, Marie Hudson.